It's the podcast between Jason Halsey talking once again with Gip Strange.
Yeah, well, that was an interesting part in your conversation with Eric Davis where I think you were talking about the period where you thought you were done with that stuff and then Jimmy Savile came up and then, you know, gotta look at that.
Yeah, well, that was... I mean, maybe it just keeps coming around in different ways, but back then it was, if I recall rightly, it was more to do with what can I focus on that's going to have a wider appeal, which I do come back to that as well quite a lot, but more than it was the feeling of, okay, I'm done, I've mapped the history of trauma now, so let's focus on the light side of things. And that's what came up on the retreat was, what about the positive aspect of my history that's hidden? There's also a hidden side to existence, including my own life, that is the opposite of dark and sinister. It's actually more deeply hidden because I can't find references for it. I know there's been a guiding principle in my life. But in terms of actually locating points at which it became conscious. All the anomalous things in my past seemed dark and sinister.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, not only is it harder to uncover that, the good thing, but it's also more difficult to express it accurately and in a way that, you know, if you're not careful, you can end up singing terrorists are acting out of love, sweet love, and making white people barbecue music. It's a lot more difficult to portray.
That's David Byrne, though, so that's not white people barbecue music.
It's a little bit. The right white people.
Right. And I mean, the whole industry of New Age optimism or spiritual optimism or all kinds of different optimism that isn't, it's not a departure from something dark. These are people who never had any, you know, real connection to dark edgy. They were just always coming up with paper thin reasons to be cheerful, as a song. But yes, this is one of my primary concerns is that, because when you talk about dark, disturbing stuff, although there are certainly plenty of ways in which it's communicated and described that aren't, you know, nuanced enough and aren't really deep or intelligent, there's clearly nowhere near the same degree of people just spouting dark, nasty stuff because it makes them feel good as there are people spouting light, spiritual, uplifting stuff because it makes them feel good. Without any substance to it.
What's that?
Without any substance.
Well, it makes me think that there's like a, you know, a pure group mimetic, you know, aspect to the whole thing. You know, like when you're an angsty teenager, there's no, you're not allowed to be happy. because your friends,
if you're that kind, but then it's the cheerleader types and they're not allowed to be unhappy.
Right.
Even the jocks have got to be rah rah, you know, positive motivated kind of.
Sure. Yeah, well, that world's totally alien to me.
Well, yeah. But it's probably more closer to the dominant.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Yeah, so this is the problem.
Trying to tap into it and find something to do with it creatively.
Well, perhaps that, or simply, I mean, because I'm a creative person anyway, so I'm going to have output, then yes, I want the output to represent new insights or new perspectives. So absolutely, yeah. But it's also, and I think that's more important, more essential, is if I have these new insights, how do I consolidate them? Well, I want to find ways to articulate them, to represent them. And that's why I'm creative in the first place. So it isn't about, I've got to keep up my creative output, need to inject it with new current perspectives. It's the opposite, or it's the flip side, which is I've got these new perspectives and I've got the tool set to creatively express. So can I apply that tool set in new ways and actually express things that A, I've never expressed before, and B, that have never been expressed well before, and C, kind of connected, that are constantly being expressed badly.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, right. Very badly.
In a way that has turned them, I mean, that's inseparable from why I have become so suspicious and critical and rejecting of interpretations of reality that are overly optimistic, transcendental, angelic, etc. And I realize now it's become more conscious because I've been aware of it quite some time. You know, there's that magical thing. Actually, this is quite a good insight. It's something maybe I can, you know, work out and express later. But you know that there's that the magical method of what if, essentially, that, and this is sort of post-Crowley, I think, that approach magic with a skeptical mindset, as in you don't really know if any of these forces are objectively real, and there may be no way to know, and so there's no reason to believe they are, but there is a reason to believe they are, because if you approach the magical operation as if it were true, then the effects will be better.
Right.
So that whole thing about using belief to bring about results, how central that is to the magical worldview, or magical method, that what I've been doing, I realize, is the opposite. I've been deconstructing with the intention of destroying all of my beliefs around these things to see if there's still something there that will manifest without the elements of belief to make it happen.
So unpack that a little more. So you've been taking away all these, your belief in any kind of magical process. And then the idea is that what's left at the end of all that would be like proof or evidence of something more than your belief, the power of belief.
Exactly. That's the Phil Dickism, isn't it? That reality is what's left when you stop believing in it.
Wow.
So, but I haven't been doing it entirely consciously. That's the interesting thing about it. Like when I write Prisoner Infinity, particularly Vice of Kings, and when I do, you know, countless podcasts where I'm talking as if I really doubt the existence of this, that, and the other, and presenting all the arguments and the evidence for why this is all part of a big, you know, cultural, socio-political, religious deception. I've really been trying on that disbelief, just as I once tried on belief. I've been trying on disbelief. Because you need a nail to knock out a nail. So if you deeply believe something without having really consciously chosen to, it's not enough to just say, well, I'll suspend my belief and cease to believe it because I don't know. It's very hard to just move from belief to non-belief. But if you move from belief to disbelief, then that disbelief is strong enough to push you out of the belief. But the goal isn't to then take a position of disbelief, it's to be then truly liminal in a position of I don't know. And that's difficult also because one is always encountering people who think they do know, right? So then I end up taking a position of disbelief because a position of non-belief isn't strong enough to counter their position of belief. Because if I just say, well, I don't know, they'll say, well, I do know.
Yeah.
And I've had experience of extraterrestrials, and that's what happened. So then I ended up saying, yes, but you were probably mind controlled, and it was probably staged, and it was probably the CIA or my lab, and da 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 da. Even though I don't necessarily believe that, I just think, how can you rule that out? You probably can't. And if you knew all of this, you definitely would be less sure about it. So I'm going to, you know, I'm going to ram this down your throat so that you'll be a bit less sure. Whereas if I said, well, some extraterrestrial encounters are, you know, controlled by humans, but some are real, that gives them an immediate out. They just go straight to, well, mine are the real ones.
Right. Well, that's an interesting problem because you're talking about a situation where you can't exist except in relation to others. And so, you know, you end up in that negative identity complex, taking a harder position than you actually.
Yeah, but that's an externalization of an internal thing because I also was once the believer.
Oh, yeah, because you have that kind of conversation happening within, too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but so when I say things like I said to Eric Davis, that, you know, all of this is in the context of an absolute certain knowledge, felt sense that there's something good, benevolent, transcendental that's guiding me through all this. He's like confused. Well, how come, you know, how come then if you believe that, how come you're, you know, most of your output or most of your arguments seem to be.
Right. Yeah, that was a great moment. That was really interesting. Sorry, go on.
Well, you can go on too. I mean, you didn't really interrupt.
Yeah, so I mean, have you thought about that since then? What is my, you know, I'm plumbing these dark depths and yet I have this sense, this faith, this, I mean, right? It's kind of faith, this intuitive sense that there is something benevolent despite all that.
Yes, but I don't see a contradiction in that. I mean, it was interesting to get his point of view because it helps me understand other people's point of view, and I can see why somebody would have that point of view, but I've never seen a contradiction in that. Just because one is aware of a benevolent force in one's life is no reason not to look at, I suppose, all the evidence to the contrary, one could say, or simply all the stuff that doesn't seem to be neutralized by that benevolent presence. Like, there is still malevolence in the world, and there's still delusion within me, and pathology and neurosis and all the rest of it. So, I mean, that to me is, in a way, that's the proof of the benevolent guiding force.
Sort of back to like the shadow is proof that there's light somewhere, you know, like we can map all the darkness and there's always going to be more darkness than there is going to be light, you know, but one is evidence of the other. Now we're back to God and the devil.
One is a backdrop to the other, and yeah, I mean, darkness in contrast to what, of course, but also like all that darkness and yet there's still visible light. Like, if everything was darkness, we wouldn't be able to begin mapping it or navigating or anything like that. It's a bit like the God is the concept by which we measure our pain line as well. We could reverse that actually and say pain is the experience by which we measure God. As in how much pain we're able to endure and yet still be oriented towards life, that's the measure of something in us that is stronger than all the pain and suffering.
That's quite an issue with atheists because you know, it's like this idea, like God testing you, testing Job. Yeah, that's a pretty big talking point for the atheist. Why is God so manipulative
and mean and
sadistic
and. It's like a Peeping Tom or something, like an evil, mad scientist experimenting on people in his laboratory. But that's a very atheistic point of view, of course. I mean, atheists are not in any position to argue theology by definition, which is an interesting point, isn't it? Because I'm sure there's a scientific equivalent to that, something about how you have to have some direct experience of the thing you're studying. You can't just, you know, imagine an atom or something and imagine what it will do and then say you've done an experiment. You've actually got to be in the laboratory observing the phenomena that you're trying to understand. So an atheist talking about God is like that. It's like a scientist just imagining atoms and then
Well, that is a lot of science. It's a lot of theorizing. I mean, there are lab scientists and there's theoretical work. That's kind of an interesting analogy, like the theoretical scientists are kind of like the what's the religious equivalent, there sort of is no, and I think that's what you're saying. There would be like theological students who could be, you know, approaching that academically.
I mean, most atheists, from what I know, they don't argue against God and religion theologically. They don't have much base. They don't have, like, I can argue with a Christian and in a way to challenge his beliefs using theology to do it. I'm not going to do a Richard Dawkins argument. Because I'm not Richard Dawkins, because I do believe in God in my own way. I just don't believe in, you know, the Christian idea about God. I do. If I refer to the scripture, I'm fine. But then the Christians' interpretation, they're always all over the map and self-contradictory and self-serving and dogmatic and obtuse and all the rest of it. I can't remember what my point was now. What was it? Oh, that atheists don't, they don't refer.
They don't have direct experience, yeah.
For A, they don't, I mean, who does, but I mean, they don't. So it's an impossible catch-22.
Sure.
Essentially, an atheist, to argue against God, would have to believe in God. Or at least have once believed in God.
Right.
Or at least study the scripture and really understand it. And I'm not sure you could really understand the scripture if you didn't have some orientation towards believing it. If you approach it just as some primitive superstition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Girard would be an interesting point, because Girard, I don't think, was religious when he started studying the Bible and the gospel and came up with scapegoats theory mechanism. He became a Catholic after, as a result of what he understood by studying the scripture.
Mm.
So he might be an interesting example of that, of somebody, of what happens if you're really rigorous enough in critical analysis of scripture. You might not necessarily convert to Catholicism, but you would end up, I suppose this is kind of what Jordan Peterson, people think he's doing. He's like taking the scriptures as seriously as a religious person, as a way to make it relevant to non-religious people.
Mm.
And hence he ends up in discussions with Sam Harris and so on.
Mm.
So that's the aspiration to that.
But what about going back to the idea of somebody who was religious and would have had some kind of experience of God and then become an atheist? Actually, last night I was reading an interview with Thomas Ligotti, and that's his story. He was raised Catholic and in his late teens. He has a very bleak philosophy.
Well, there's another thing there, which I've said before, which is anyone who's a nihilist, who claims to be a nihilist and yet is arguing for nihilism, isn't practicing nihilism.
Right. Yeah.
Because if you truly believe that nothing means anything, you would just stop speaking and stop acting and, I mean, maybe you'd keep eating and shitting because you have to. You certainly stop trying to persuade people and have philosophical conversations.
Yeah.
It's also similar to what prompted this part of the conversation too, which is my semi-conscious position of not believing in certain things to see if they would still
be there.
Still be there. Yeah. And in the book of Job, that's basically what he's being tested for, is whether he will deny God. Or at least curse God, like his wife and everyone else is saying. Just curse God and be done with it. And Job is refusing. Like, he continues to believe in the goodness of God despite everything, and that's how God wins his bet. And I would say, I mean Jung wrote a whole book about Job, and I'm sure that a lot of it was Gnostic and whatever, you know, dubious in its way, but I think part of his argument I would agree with, or at least I find meaningful, was to do with that God, at least at that stage in God's evolution, or man's evolution, or whatever we're going to call that, man's evolving awareness of God was an unconscious force, and that Job was a precursor to Christ, in the sense that Job was part of the means or the mechanism by which God was becoming conscious of himself via man, via humanity. So when God was testing Job, just as when God sacrificed Christ, he was testing himself, essentially.
Mm.
Like I have...
Like you're doing.
I have extended my being into the human realm I've extended my consciousness into this lowest kind of realm in order to experience, in order that, you know, matter may experience itself as aware, but also that the divine might experience itself as matter, as a material, finite being. And central to that is that feeling of being utterly abandoned. So Job gets abandoned by God because the devil has his way with him and God does nothing. Christ on the cross, why hast thou forsaken me, also has this quintessential experience of being abandoned by God. Without losing faith in the Christian sense, without losing touch with that deep sense of the goodness of God or the meaning of existence, the truth, even though there's no evidence left to believe in it.
Right. Right. And you're conducting a similar test.
Well, I don't mind being put in that company of Job and Jesus, but I'm not quite sure I see it just yet.
Well, in that taking away all these things, these beliefs, to test and see if they're what's there after. It's similar, right?
Except it's spiritual autolysis is the phrase that's coming to mind, Jed McKenna thing, but it's an internal process that it doesn't seem as though it's being done to me by some higher power. It seems more as though I am volunteering to do it, but it doesn't even seem like that. It just seems as though maybe it's like Jesus rejecting the devil's temptations in the desert. Maybe it's a bit like that, because that was also that he was subjecting himself to a kind of abandonment in the desert, you know, no food, no sleep, no companionship. But anyway, I mean, it doesn't seem to me like it began as some sort of conscious discipline or devotional or anything like that. It just seemed it began with the growing recognition that I had prematurely taken on beliefs and that they had led me astray. But bring it back to that point to Eric Davis. My ears have just popped. Although I doubted the existence of angels and extraterrestrials and sorcery and any other number of sort of phenomena that I'd seen as benign and empowering, although I ended up doubting all of those things, I never ended up doubting. I've never even come close to the point of doubting the existence of God, so to speak. I have to put the so to speak on the end, because I can certainly doubt the existence of a word or the meaning of a word, but I mean what people refer to as God. I've never doubted that I was embedded in something much greater than myself and being guided by it. Although I suppose that might be questionable, because I've acted as if I doubted it for sure. And actually two things might be related, because all the storming heaven stuff, it seems as that would be driven by doubt. Just as one of the devil's temptations to Jesus is throw yourself down to see if the angels will lift you up. It's as if I did that with all of my attempts to bootstrap my way into galactic consciousness, incarnate Lucifer, redeem Lucifer and all of that. Like I was coming at it from the opposite approach. And that also seems similar to my brother's position, which was, if God exists, I'm going to defy God, as if to force God to show his face.
Everybody's always trying to get the other person to prove their love.
Yeah. Right, true. And children, of course, do that. If their parents are negligent, they will act up and get punished just to get attention. Even punishment is a kind of love.
Right, yeah. It's better than nothing.
Yeah. So maybe that's why all these Christians believe in hell so fiercely, because it's hell itself as a belief is an affirmation of God, of a twisted God's love. I mean, it's a twisted idea about God's love, but still, God created hell in order to throw the sinners in it. And I suppose with the traumatic conditioning, it's a lot easier for many of us to believe in hell than it is to believe in God's love. I mean, we've got a world, haven't we, to constantly remind us what hell might be like.
Yeah, right. Right. It's easier to imagine, and it comes with cooler special effects, you know.
It is easy to imagine, even that the basic thing of eternal, existing eternally, it's much easier to imagine that being hellish than being heavenly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Eternity sounds more hellish than heavenly.
So my project has been about mapping hell on earth, and there's so much evidence for that one could be mapping forever. That's the problem. But by the same token, there's so much evidence of it that it's very easy to make arguments for it, even though I am mapping something that many people refuse to see. So it's not as though it seems superfluous. It does seem like it has a purpose and a function to help people see something they're not seeing that's hellish. But as I say, like, it's, I've got lots of evidence to draw on. And, you know, the more I dig, the more I find it. But evidence for heaven on earth, or any kind of heaven, it would seem as though that's, I mean, you'd think that that would be more useful to people, actually. But it's much harder to find. And if it's found, it's much harder to hold on to. And if it's found and held on to, it's much harder to describe.
Express, yeah. Yeah.
Standing on the street in the light of a lamp, she looks so innocent, 15 years old. She's lived 1,000 lives in the heads of lonely men. Makes love to a syringe every time she feels the need. Thank you. God is going to let us know the truth in a few years. Man says this while people stare and chuckle to themselves. He feels that it's his duty to change their points of view. But he can't listen, and they will never find the truth.
Maybe it's like Dave said, that if we were all enlightened, we wouldn't talk about enlightenment.
what do you mean? What's the connection?
If we were living in the kingdom of heaven now, then nobody would be talking about God.
Oh, I see. Right.
Because we'd already be one with, we'd be reunited.
It'd be all light, no shadow. You'd be right in the middle of the sun.
Yeah, you would be front and center, identified with the sun, aligned with the sun anyway. Because to be identified with would be heresy for the Christian, not to mention making the sun as equivalent to God is you know, Luciferian. But anyway, jumping over those little minor details. There's something really, I think, self-evident. So my first insight, or the turning point for me in which I began to orientate myself towards the divine, was the awareness of the absence in my life, as I've described in other places, other times. It was that acute awareness of something missing in my life that signaled to me that there was something I wanted to find or connect to.
That there was something there that wasn't there.
Yeah, the God who wasn't there. So then that's hell, isn't it? Like hell on earth, human suffering and anguish and misery. It's constantly, again, back to this, pain is the experience by which we measure the absence of God, you could say. That would be it, wouldn't it? And the absence of God indicates the presence of God. Right? So, you know, if we feel the absence of our Father, then we know there's a Father somewhere that we're not. We're not in touch with.
Just flashed in my head William S. Burroughs' last diary entry. Love is the most natural painkiller. He makes a drug analogy.
Right.
But that's okay. God is the natural painkiller. Same thing, right? God is love.
Yeah, so pain is how we measure the absence of God, so then pain is also how we orient ourselves towards the presence that we need to fill the absence. Even the pain is a signal of our own disconnect from that within us that is connected to God. It's not really God's absence. It's a shutting down, like Dostoevsky's hell knows the incapacity of love. The suffering that comes from an incapacity to love is hell. So the incapacity within ourselves to connect to God's love, which is the incapacity to feel love, essentially, that we experience that either as unbearable pain, or it would be on a spectrum, or as numbness and emptiness and, you know, despair, like at the furthest end of things, these supposedly damned souls, they don't even feel the numbness, they just feel, I suppose, a pathological drive to achieve more power over their environment, whatever the hell they feel. I mean, who knows? Actually, at that level, I suppose I have to refer to my own experience there. But anyway, it's, there are layers, aren't there? And underneath, you know, underneath those layers, there's the anguish and the pain of being disconnected.
Right.
And then underneath that is the connection.
Well, with those damned souls too, you would want to factor in, like, to keep with the analogy of the parenting, the parent, and that for a child, abuse is better than nothing. And then when that child grows up, it will seek out abuse as part of its pattern. You could say that the damned souls also would be like in a kind of masochistic cycle of heaping more pain upon themselves.
Oh, sadomasochistic.
Yeah, right. So...
Yeah, so then you have an S&M dungeon as the only place that people can seek love, yeah.
Now that's a hell I can believe in. That's a hell I can get behind. I mean, there is such a thing as being in love with pain, right? So.
Yeah, I think it's where we end up asserting our individuality, our independence. Like, that's the corner that we end up in, an S&M dungeon of never-ending sadomasochistic agony.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we get to reign in hell.
Yeah, I think of your brother again.
Or your father, but really any of us, to whatever degree.
She's saying reign in hell, meaning like the king of pain, you know?
And maintaining sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, I see. Because God means surrendering to something outside yourself. Right? Sovereignty meaning...
Even love does.
Right, right. Got to let somebody in and turn yourself inside out.
And relinquish power over your own well-being, essentially. To love someone deeply is to relinquish your power to protect yourself from pain, isn't it?
Hmm.
I mean, Christians, they got a Bible to refer to, and not much else, really.
Mm-hmm.
So, they got the belief in an all-loving, all-powerful God on one side of them. They got a belief in a relatively all-powerful, all-malevolent devil, as in relative to them. It's actually an interesting... There's a spectrum there, isn't it? Because the devil relative to a human being, is all powerful, or rather, relative to the devil, a human being is powerless, and the devil is all powerful. But relative to God, the devil is powerless, because God is truly all powerful. So it's almost as though the devil is a kind of stopgap in the human, in the human ability to conceive of an infinite power. On the way to that conception, you've got the devil.
Right.
As in, that's as powerful as we can conceive of, and he's the devil. So we absolutely have to admit that we're powerless before the wiles of the devil. He can do with us what he wants. But, fortunately, there's God there. And so if we surrender to God, who's beyond anything we can even imagine, and therefore is really more terrifying even than the devil.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we'll be saved from the devil.
Right. Right.
But anyway, that was digressing to say that. And the devil can, it's only God really that can send us to hell, but the devil will arrange the circumstances by which we end up going to hell. Because we've got free will, but our nature is such, because we're created in the divine image, if it weren't for the devil, we would end up, you know, returning to God and living in his bosom for all eternity. But because the devil's there to trick us, if we're not 24/7 vigilant, we'll end up falling into the traps that he lays, and we'll end up burning in hell for all eternity. So the only thing we've really got, besides faith in God, who's unknowable and unseeable, is the Bible. And that, well, I mean, if all you've got is a book as a stopgap or a doorstopper for hell or whatever, it's the opposite of a doorstopper, isn't it? You want it to actually block the gate to somehow.
The guide to avoiding hell?
Yeah, to come between you and hell.
Right.
Isn't there a movie in which they kill the devil by making him eat a book? I remember seeing that movie not so long ago. And of course, the book represents the Word, the living Word. So it's not as though it's completely batshit crazy or anything, but it could drive a person batshit crazy. If they're constantly aware that they need guidance in every moment not to fall into the temptation of the devil and end up burning in hell for all eternity, all they got is the Bible, and they've just got to keep referring to the Bible to tell them what to do. Obviously, the Bible doesn't really meet every occasion. Like, you know, should I go on this dating site or not? Should I watch the latest Netflix thing or not? You're not going to find much help in the Bible. So it puts an unnatural onus on Scripture to guide us. When there's, I mean, actually the Christian belief, I think it is, but I'm not sure, but it must be that God is watching us at all times. That I know is part of it. We don't have a thought that God doesn't know about. But I think by extension that would also imply, and I certainly believe this to be the case in my own understanding of these mysteries, that the divine forces or powers that rule our fate are also guiding us. They're also offering guidance in every moment. So like if God or angelic beings are observing our every thought and watching our every decision, they're also, it's not neutral. They're not just like some overseeing computer or, you know, overlord, machine overlord that's just recording everything. They're involved. So they're like the devil and the angel on each other. We're constantly receiving guidance in every moment about what to say and what to do and where to look and how to move and all of that. So the Bible is really just a device for capturing your attention, or it's, you know, a way to reassert one's devotion or one's whatever the word is for that, you know, loyalty to God, one's compliance, one's obedience, rather than being a real instrument that can guide us. Because there'll be no substitute for the body. Because Christians say the body leads us into sin. So that's probably central to the problem, right? That belief that the body is born and created in original sin. Anyway, I came away from this retreat with a felt sense that who I actually am extends into other invisible realms of, and that who I actually am is part of a collective of some sort, and that that collective intelligence is always guiding me. But without the means to really be able to refer to that guidance, you know, like I can acknowledge it, and that's just the first step. But in terms of actually being able to read it or interpret it or experience it, there isn't much there by way of, you know, a readable signal.
Right. And you can't summon it at will, right? That's part of that too, right?
Summon what, though?
That connection. Like, you have a sense that that exists, that there's part of you that exists in other realms, but you're not getting a readable signal and you can't tune into it at will, right?
Right. I can't tune into it well because it's outside of my mind and it transcends the body. So the closest I can do is pay attention to my body and at the same time remember. It's almost like remember to believe what I know, which is that my every thought and word and deed is being observed.
Yikes.
And not by disinterested parties.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, that's a thought or a feeling that I've had a lot myself, and it's definitely a thought It used to be that when I'd have that thought, I'd push it out of my mind because it was so uncomfortable to me. And there are so many things that I want to forget, right? Just what I need, something that's on the permanent record, you know?
Right. So, but that's, you went to that, to a permanent record from the moment, you know, the present moment, which isn't about it being recorded, it's about it being observed.
Right.
So, anyway, I cut you off. I mean, it sounded like you have also a different attitude to it as well, besides.
Yeah. I mean, I want to get into like letting go of regrets and stuff. That would be tied into that whole conversation, which is not where we're kind of focused. But so it's Big Mother without the, I mean, it's the, what it is, it's what Big Mother's a counterfeit for. So, We also, we couldn't say that Big Mother is indifferent. Like you're saying, angel, devil on the shoulder. it's tempting to say Big Mother is just the devil on the shoulder.
Well, the Big Mother, I mean, it's true that there are prompts and cues and manipulations from Big Mother, of course, because it's not neutral and it's not passive, but it does seem primarily about monitoring and collating data, doesn't it?
Right.
Yes, it's constantly suggesting things, it's true, buy this, buy that. That's part of its, that's part of the network.
Gods of capitalism. Jeez.
So, well, maybe I should just talk about more about my experience then, because it's, otherwise it's very abstract, and it's hardly even my experience, but anyway, my impression of this is that there's a two-way thing going on. One is that I'm here in this life incarnate to gather intel, and I'm sending it back constantly to the central high command that sent me here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been my mission, is to map hell, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the only way to map hell was to go all the way to the most recondite corner, get lost, and then find my way out again, just as I did with Dark Oasis and Crowley and Strieber. It seems to be the recurring thing. Get lost in some maze of delusional, destructive, abusive beliefs, and then find your way out.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've mapped it. But this is extended to the whole of my life and the whole of this Earth realm, let's say. So, yeah, I had to get totally lost, and then, you know, over 20 years, or the first 20 years, getting, or even 30 years, or even 40 years, 35 years, let's say, getting totally lost, and then the last 15 or so, finding my way out.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously very rough, and I couldn't be sure about what the time frame is. And so, yeah, throughout that process, I've been, without quite realizing it, I've been sending this intel like a probe that's sent to some other planet, transmitting back to the home base all the necessary, you know, information for a, you know, for a future mission there, when the whole fleet arrives or whatever. Could extend it to that if we wanted. While on the other hand, in order to see me through that process, I've constantly been receiving intel from Central High Command, as in from the original family network, extraterrestrial hive mind that I was issued from, you know, that I volunteered, ET phone home, to get lost, you know. Anyway, so yeah, two-way. And obviously I've been aware of the stuff I've been sending, even if I haven't been aware of sending it, because that's been my experience. And I've been dimly aware of the stuff I've been receiving, because I have always been somewhat aware that, yeah, there's a purpose for this. Yeah, there's something guiding me through this. Yeah, I'm lost, but I can find my way out. Yeah, something's helping me at all times. Yeah, I don't belong here. Yeah, I'm not from here. I'm actually from elsewhere. And I've just got to get all through this and out so that I can go home again. There's always been that, those sorts of impressions that I've had. And they've either been easily incorporated into a quasi-Christian or religious belief about God watches us over us at all times, or the spirit, or the implicate order, or they've been more complexly developed or constructed out of Castaneda or Whitley Strieber or other influences that have a more specific kind of thing, like I'm part of some undercover operation of chosen ones who had to come here from elsewhere and forget who they were and then gradually wake up to their true nature by finding one another. And all this ties into some sort of alien slash extraterrestrial slash sorceress second attention network that I'm part of.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so either both of those things have been part of my belief, and those are the beliefs, not the God one, because that's just very general and that didn't seem like it was too pernicious because I couldn't really get ego invested in it, but all the other stuff about the specifics, that is what I've been thoroughly debunking for myself over the last 10 years or so, because of A, it seemed like it wasn't really helpful, and B, if it was true, then it shouldn't depend on my belief, and my belief actually might be distorting the reality,
mm-hmm.
which I know it did. Assuming there is a reality, I definitely managed to distort it quite badly by relying on second and third hand testimonials to describe to me what it was, or to give me a framework for understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't rule out the possibility that Philip K. Dick, Carlos Castaneda, Whitley Strieber, even Aleister Crowley, when hooked into these sorts of networks or whatever it is we're talking about, but that they faithfully reproduced it and that they really were true to that allegiance is definitely more than in question. I would say it's firmly established as not true. Like they were not faithful representatives of that transmission.
They failed their mission.
Yeah. And they would have failed it largely by mistaking conceptual beliefs and whatnot for a lived experience, I'd say. Although part of that would have been becoming spokespeople for it.
Well, see, it's almost like by that very definition, the ones who would succeed in their message, you would never ever hear about, They would.
Well, I think it's why I like Philip K. Dick, because it seems as though he failed and was aware of failing, and then he kind of followed the failure rather than trying to cover up and compensate, and double down. He just like, okay, I can't do this, so I'm just going to spend the last years of my life writing a book that no one will read, just trying to figure out what the hell happened.
Mm.
And he was obscure and unknown by the time he died. And so somehow he does represent to me, like, I would say Dick was much less of a failure than the others. And I've already said that relates to him not falling for the devil's temptation, which isn't in the gospel, but I suppose maybe it's like turning stones into bread, or I don't know, but as in becoming a somebody, becoming a leader.
Sure, sure, sure. And inherent in that, I feel like, would be you would want to keep going in the maze, and you wouldn't want to like plant your flag on a certain territory and say, this is it, I've got it figured out. And what you're saying about Dick is he just kept going. I mean, that book is kind of like watching somebody chase their thoughts in circles. Which I guess would be I don't know. Wouldn't you say the other guys are like, ah, I've got it, I've found the answer, and now I'm the leader, and follow me? Isn't that all part of the... So you're not, they're claiming to have the maze solved, but I've sort of been corrupted by the maze.
It's like The Shining, isn't it?
Beware of seekers who claim to have found what they were seeking. Maybe that's part of it too, you know?
Well, that would describe Dave Ashana. So I'm not sure it's quite as simple as that. That's why I was lost for words there, because, and I'm at the stage where I would say that what my sense is what happened on the retreat, on this last retreat, was it was communicated to me that this mission that I described of mapping the maze was more or less completed. So that would mean that I was ready to leave the maze, to leave this dimension and return to the true dimension. But that wouldn't mean physically leaving. And so if I was physically still here, then the maze that I'd mapped would still be here too, even if I was no longer in it.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean by that?
Because
mm-hmm. the maze is a mind. It's like the mind is a replica of the maze or the labyrinth and vice versa. So it's only when we're still trapped in our mind that we experience ourselves as trapped in the maze. Once we're outside of our minds, we can still see the maze and move through it, but we're on a higher level, so we don't ever get lost in it, because
mm-hmm.
we're seeing it, you know, as a cross-section, which is in The Shining, that scene where he's looking down at the maze.
God's eye point of view.
Yeah, God's eye view. So then, I mean, I think that the tell about those characters wasn't that they found their way through the maze and then said, I can leap. Well, maybe it was that they believed that, but they continued to talk about the maze from the perspective of the maze, but as if they had made it out. They were talking, but they were offering a way out of the maze, but they went out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So for them to believe that they knew the way out, that was a self-serving fantasy. It was as if they believed they knew the way out, they could find the way out. And if they could persuade others they believed they knew the way out, then they would really believe it.
Yeah.
But they were still describing the maze from the inside. So they were trying to deduce their way out. They were saying, I have this Bible, I have this system, I have the visitors, I have, you know, whatever else it is, this knowledge base that tells me the way out. But mm-hmm. actually, it doesn't. Not really. Or at least knowing the way out isn't enough to leave the maze. Because that's not how the maze works. Probably because it's constantly changing. The maze is constantly changing. And so yeah. you can take a picture of it and say, ah, now I know what the maze looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you're actually outside the maze,
yeah.
you don't know what's changed.
Right.
I think that's the error, and I think that's the devil's temptation. He tempts us with knowledge and says, if you take this knowledge, you'll become as gods. And you can navigate the maze like I can navigate the maze. But he never tells us that he's a prisoner too.
Thank you. You're in the seat of design. You have deceived your entire family of design.
But you even know that
you have leaned. You have your
Are you saying on this last retreat, the message you got is putting you in the same position of, you know, these people, these failed agents, where you have made it through the maze and you're ready to return? Is that are you saying that's a false temptation?
Well, I wasn't consciously saying that, but it might be. I'm sure there's a reason why we're talking. I think, you know, my experience, as I've articulated today, is I don't know what to do with this newfound sense, which I don't even want to call an insight, but it was to some degree experiential. I can see what existence is like outside the maze now, outside the mind, and it's over there, and it's just waiting for me. Journey of zero distance. Mm. But it didn't, from that, I didn't determine, well, how do I take that?
Right.
That last step.
It's just a sense of knowing that there's something waiting for you. It's good to have something to look forward to, right?
Well, there you go. Exactly. It isn't just some mind generated project, a carrot.
Mm.
You know, computer-generated carrot to gaze at. But paradoxically, it's sort of the opposite of a carrot, which is not a whip. But as in, it leaves me unmotivated because, I mean, that's the thing that is of value. That's the thing that I'm oriented towards. As far as I know, and I did kind of receive this message too, the only thing to do is to trust the process and wait.
Right.
But then that, by extension, the only thing I could do to prevent it would be distrust the process and not wait, as in get pulled into sort of compulsive activity that I think is going to get me where I want to get to.
Wait, I don't follow. Why make that turn to do that?
Well, indeed, why would I? We're a lifetime's habit, right? Because
right.
It's very hard just to wait.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you do when you wait? Well, you chop water, you carry wood.
Mm. Sounds like you're
I
just...
always do that. I always get them backwards. Sounds like what?
You're describing my attitude toward the summer, you know?
Yeah, that's why fruit picking seemed like a good option, possibly, because it's very much, you really are chopping wood, carrying water there, almost literally. So you're being productive and you're involved in physical life, but it's not meaningful.
Yeah, and it's a test of patience. And
I mean, it is meaningful, but it's not titillating to the mind. It's not offering any carrot. The only carrot you have when you're picking fruit is,
okay,
I'm going to fill this container in a few minutes and I'll get to empty it. Woohoo! And then the day's going to end in half an hour and I'm going to, it's just the working stiff's kind of carrot.
Yeah, but there's something to be said for that the only carrot that there is the carrot that you're picking, that you're actually picking, you're actually going to eat, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real carrot, at least.
The real carrot.
I hear a voice that's not my own. It tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen. Some point they become the family of one.